Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Node. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my very special guest is former Apple executive and technology analyst, Michael Gartenberg. Michael, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
You've been a stellar guest. You've been on many times, and we've been in the habit now of doing special events. And what I thought I would do was get your take on the new iPhone X. You have yours already. Mine doesn't arrive until December 1st. I'm so bummed. So I thought what I'd do is just sort of ask you about your reactions to the iPhone 10, how you're feeling about it, and just kind of do a special rundown. How's that sound?
Yeah, the iPhone 10 is one of the most impressive products that Apple has ever done, probably one of the most impressive products that anyone has ever done. There's more technology that people are putting in their pockets right now that you could not have dreamed of 10 years ago when the iPhone was introduced. To talk about the iPhone 10 back then would be about as realistic as my beaming up to the Starship Enterprise.
How are you feeling about the price, first of all?
The price is high. There's no doubt about it. But when the iPhone first came out, my thoughts were iPhone was eventually going to break down into different models and price points, the same way the iPod had. You had the iPod that was first introduced. Then you had everything from the iPod Touch, the iPod Classic, the iPod Nano, the iPod Mini, the iPod Shuffle, and they were all iPods. And now you have the same situation with the phone. You have this high-end aspirational product called the iPhone 10. It's not going to be for everyone, but I think it's going to lure a lot of people into the stores. And when they leave, they may not walk out with a 10, well, if nothing else, because they're hardly any 10s to find. But I think they're still going to walk out with an iPhone product and be part of the iPhone ecosystem. So what Apple has done is really created something that goes from the iPhone 10 all the way up down to the iPhone SE. And the thing about them is they're all iPhones. Everyone who has one of those can say they're part of the Apple ecosystem. They're part of the iPhone ecosystem, and they're just as cool as the next person. But, you know, they may be driving a Honda Civic instead of a high-end Acura.
How do you feel about the scaling? I think the original, not original, but the previous generations of iPhone 6, 7, were roughly 250 in parts and sold for 650. So now there's about 350 in parts and it's gone up $300. Do you see a proper scaling there?
Well, we're guessing about those parts. You know, there's folks that tear these things down and try and do analysis. And it's hard to always come up with legitimate numbers. So I'm skeptical of those numbers. But assuming they're even correct, you know, at the end of the day, Apple is in business to, one, make money, and two, this is meant to be a premium product. This is an aspirational product. This is not a product for everyone. This is something that, again, brings people into the store. It may not be what they leave with. And, you know, the one thing we know about Apple and the one thing we know about iPods and iPhones is the prices will come down. So the technology we're seeing today will be available tomorrow at somewhat of reduced cost. And it's the question of, you know, how much do you want to be part of that ecosystem? And to be clear, this isn't about, you know, taking out your iPhone and putting it down on the bar and like, ooh, I've got a 10 and you've only got a, you know, 6.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I don't think so because it doesn't look that different.
Until you light up the screen, you see that gorgeous OLED and those glorious whites and blacks.
I I think this is still a product that's for the people who want the product. It's not a product that's designed to impress. It's not a showy product. It's not like they did it in, 18 karat gold, an iPod, Pro Edition. Or
why do you think there's only two colors?
I think that that comes down to just what Apple feels is appropriate at this particular time. Why did rose gold go away to this new version of gold? It's a shifting of colors. It's the same way automobiles change in colors in subtle ways and in different ways. Sometimes it's a way of showing the difference. If I put down my iPhone 8, it's not rose gold. Or if I used to put down my rose gold, it was clear that it was a rose gold, not a, 5. But that doesn't go into a whole lot of Apple thinking, at least from my time there. It's the question of what looks good right now for this particular product, and taking it out there. And if you look at the products, they're basically, you've got, they're calling it space gray, but for the rest of us, we'll just call it black and silver. And what's interesting is, and I looked this up before we spoke, the two most popular colors for cars are silver and black. So when you're talking about a premium product, perhaps you want to just make it as simple as possible for people to say, do I want silver? Do I want, the space gray edition? And take it from there, because the focus is not on,
Seriously, it's just so that people don't look at you in the bar and say, you paid $1,000 for rose gold? Oh, yuck.
And let's face it, this is one of those cases where I was totally wrong, where I thought Apple was going to come in at a $999 product, but with 128 gigabyte, and then something higher at 256. The 64 gig product, if you're buying this particular product, the 64 gig product is absurd.
Gene Munster thinks that that's the number, that's the bigger seller of the two because of the price issue.
Well, Gene Munster has been, predicting an Apple TV and always.
Come on. He's still okay guy.
He's an okay guy, but I question his predictions. I question everyone's predictions. They're always going to be wrong.
Let's talk about how you feel about yours. Tell me first about the setup, the enlist. Is it called enlisting in facial ID? How did that go? How quick was it? And how fast does it log you on?
First of all, setting up Face ID is absurdly simple. It takes you through the process, and basically what you want to do is kind of move your nose around in a circle, and you want to do it twice. The accuracy that I found is near perfect. And, just to give an example, when I first got mine, I had grown a scruffy, almost David Letterman-like beard. And that's, when I had enrolled it. And then when, my family insisted that I shave it off, it had absolutely no problem recognizing me. I've used it in light. I've used it in dark. I've worn hats. I've worn sunglasses.
Have you tried to log out in the sunlight? Does the infrared lasers still have no problem?
Yeah. In, like I said, in the middle of the day, no problem. Now, has it been perfect? No. There's been times when I've had to look at it twice, put it down and look at it again. But I've had the same issue with, Touch ID. It hasn't always recognized my fingerprint. Sure. And of course, the nice part about this is I don't have to enroll this particular finger or that particular finger. I just enroll my face. And, if you're willing to turn off the, super authentication where you've got to be, gazing at it directly, then it's basically 100%. Obviously, it's always good. And I recommend to people, turn on the highest level of security. Better you have to do it twice. than someone coming after you. But so far, you know, we just haven't seen anyone come close to saying, hey, this isn't any good. And I know we saw one person who did a certain, you know, facial mold and that spent hours and thousands of dollars. I mean, if you're willing to do that, you can have my phone. It's all yours.
I thought I had to check for blinks.
Yeah, I mean, but we blink so fast that, like I said, it happens almost instantaneously. And, you know, what's interesting is people talk about, well, you have to learn new gestures. We all had a new gestures back in 2007. Pinch to zoom, these swiping, these things were foreign concepts. What I found is the recognition is so fast and your muscle memory becomes to swipe up so quickly, you don't even notice it. Most of the time, I back of my brain is like, was this thing even locked?
I've heard that too.
Because it happens so quickly. And yeah, there are definitely new gestures and swipes to learn. But one of the things Apple has always been great at is teaching new things. There are tutorials in terms of setting up the device to give you a sense of what's going on and how to do things. And I think for most people who are going to buy this thing, it's going to take them, you know, a couple of hours before they get used to doing certain things, because you know, the muscle memory of Touch ID and what we've seen in, you know, other devices is learned. So you're basically learning a new concept, except for the fact that it works. And, you know, this is one of those things where Apple would not have put this into a product. They would not have released a product unless it had this type of accuracy rate. And, you know, one of the things that kind of blew me away was when they showed that they went to Hollywood and had, you know, realistic masks of people's faces. I mean, you know, the high-end stuff that you really do. And Face ID said, nope, that's not the person. So I think for most people, the security is going to be more than enough. And again, learning the gestures will take you a little bit of time in terms of using. And the accuracy, to me, I found it roughly the same as Touch ID. There were a few times when I had a look at it twice. And to me, that's not a particularly big deal. This is a pretty big innovation, and it's kind of important.
Excellent, excellent. How do you feel about the build quality because of the glass casing? Is it smoother? I've heard people talk about how it seems to be a cut above the previous phones in terms of the fit and finish.
Well, I've been using both the 10 as well as the 8 series, and I can tell you, I'm just not a particular fan of any device that's made entirely out of glass, no matter how good it is. I just go back to the, you know, iPhone 4 series, and, you know, it's just, you have one more thing to drop. On one hand, you really don't want to use it in a case because it is so beautiful to hold. On the other hand, you figure a case can hurt because it at least will protect half of the device. I think we've seen, you know, replacing the device or fixing the device as being high, or replacing the glass as being high. This is the first device that I would say, yeah, I'm buying AppleCare and AppleCare Plus on this particular thing.
I did that too, and mine's going to go straight into an OtterBox Defender.
It just loses too much. You know, you put it into a case like that, and, you know, I've been using even Apple's leather case, which doesn't add that much. It just loses some of the design of it, and I don't know what the right word is, the purity of the design. So I've been taking mine in and out, And I'm not quite sure where I'm going to leave it, but I know there's definitely a different feel and a look to the device when you're holding it, when it's not in a case. On the other hand, if you happen to drop it in your driveway, you might be wishing that you had one of those OtterBox cases.
I dropped an iPhone, I forget what it was, maybe a 4S or a 5, in a clear plastic polycarbonate case, cracked the case. I dropped it when I was getting out of the car onto the asphalt, and the case cracked real well, and the phone was in perfect condition.
Well, I can tell you that, in Apple, you're issued an iPhone. So I recall using an iPhone 6 Plus at the time and going through at least four of those in one way or the other. Fortunately, in Apple, you get to bring it into the repair center and they just kind of give it right back to you. the Plus size absolutely slipped out of my hands without a case. The 8 feels a lot different, at least in terms of, I don't know, grippability, as well as the Plus.
Well, that's my next question. You know, I handled Jeff Gamet's when we got together recently, and it's tall and thin. Maybe that helps with one-handed operation with a thumb, but it is kind of oddly thin in terms of width to height ratio. Does that? How do you feel about that? Are you a one-handed user?
I've never been a one-handed user. I'm just kind of a, two-handed klutz, if you will, that needs to type. But for a lot of the things, this is one hand. I mean, you have to go back and talk about how Apple just kind of broke the laws of physics here. You have a larger display than you have in an 8 Plus, and something that is a fraction bigger than an 8 or its predecessor, the 7. So it's not quite the one-hand device of the SE form factor, but it is relatively, I found, easy to use with one hand for most things, and certainly a less awkward than the plus-size devices. But again, those are for me. I've never been comfortable with the Plus devices. They've always just been a little too large for me, even going back to the 7 series and the better camera. I was willing to sacrifice that. And you look at this device, I'm like, I'm making no sacrifices whatsoever, and I'm getting an even better camera, although I don't think most people are going to notice the difference at this point. So you are talking about a device, at least from, grippability, handability, usability, as to being really well balanced. And that's a credit to Apple, because it could easily have been something that's just a little too wide or a little too tall.
And grippability factor. That's cool.
And I think it's, to me, it's almost a perfectly balanced device.
Cool. Well, we're going to have to take a break right now. And we'll come back, and I want to ask you some more about your experiences with the iPhone X. Folks, we're listening to Michael Gartenberg talk about his experiences with his new iPhone X. We will be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Michael Gartenberg. So what do you think about Super Retina, 450 plus pixels per inch? What's going on there, and do we really need that, and does it show? What's the story there?
So first, small plug, if you listen to TMO and you're using it, please go to their homepage. It doesn't cost you anything extra, and it helps support this. Anyhow, back to the super duper Retina display. I mean, it's awesome. It's beautiful. If you're looking at it, I don't see the difference. If I put it next to a different device, sure. An AMOLED display is great. I, you know, remember writing any number of pieces that basically said, you know, when we had this question at Apple, we would not use AMOLED displays or OLED displays because they simply weren't good enough for Apple standards. And this is clearly one that is good enough. The screen is beautiful. There's no other way to describe it.
Whites are so white as a characteristic of OLED.
Right. And the blacks are perfectly black because the displays aren't lighting up. You don't have a pixel lighting up. It's basically a pure black. So the display itself, again, when you put it next to something else, you go, oh, wow. But even when you look at it, everything seems easier to read. Everything seems to look that much better. It's, again, pretty an amazing job because OLED was something Apple had stayed away from, except for watches and not in phones. And this is the first time we've seen it. And that probably adds to some of the cost here is because this has to be an, you know, AMOLED display that meets Apple's standards. Not putting one on and saying, okay, there's a benefit to this, but there's a trade-off to that. It's hard to see. Well, I should say I can't see any loss by using this display. And on the other hand, you go, wow, everything just is beautiful. It's vivid. It's not oversaturated. Apple did a great job tuning each device.
So again, circuitry to keep it from burning.
Yeah. You know, and again, that's sort of geeky, you know, technology people worried about, you know, burn-in technology on AMOLED displays. And Apple does say if you're taking the same high, you know, resolution definition picture, then you're going to leave it on your display for hours and hours and days at a time. Sure. And like all OLED displays, if you're looking at it from a slightly, you know, actually a particularly hard side view, you're going to see a little bit of color shifting and a little bit of hue. But it's something I've never noticed because most of the time you're just looking at the phone straight on. You're not looking at the phone from that side. So I think Apple made the right decision by going with, you know, AMOLED displays here. And this is the next generation of iPhone and, you know, likely iPad too. We're going to see all of this core technology make its way down to other devices, make its way down at lower price points. And, you know, Apple will continue to add its innovation that's associated with this. And, you know, like I said, make note about it. It's amazing to me. This is the most sophisticated piece of technology that I have ever seen in a handheld device that I can stick in my pocket.
600 and you say, billion wow. operations per second. Probably not yeah. floating point operations, or they would have said that, but 600 billion operations per second, still pretty good. Still pretty good.
Right. Can't even imagine that. The fluidity of the device in terms of how it goes from one application to another or back to the home screen. These things just happen. And I think what's fantastic about it is you don't notice it. It just happens. There's no, you know, delay. There's no waiting. There's no glitching.
Speaking of waiting, have you had a chance to try the inductive charger? I've heard it's on the slow side.
You know, define to me slow side.
Slower than a direct cable.
Well, yeah, probably. I haven't, you know, tested it out. But in normal daily use, and first of all, this thing has fantastic battery life. One, if you need to top it off, to me, it's sitting on my end table. I just put it down and it tops off. And when I use it, you know, to charge, as most people do at night, again, I just put it down and it charges. And do I care if it takes a little bit longer at night? Nah, not so much. What I do find is the convenience is that if I need to use the phone at night, if someone is, you know, texting me in the middle of the night or someone, you know, needs to reach me, the ability and the convenience to just take it off and look at it is great.
That's a good point.
Yeah, look, I mean, Apple didn't invent this. Apple is kind of late to market, you know, in terms of this technology. But the nice part, like all of Apple's technology, it just works. And it's going to be really interesting to see when Apple brings out its own, you know, charging device, how that's going to affect things. But again, the ability to be able to just say, put my phone down, put my AirPods down, put my watch down, and not even think about, you know, plugging in or tapping or making sure everything is correct, is huge. And, you know, we'll see. Hopefully Apple's charger will be a little bit faster. But the nice part about it is you're not stuck with that. If you really feel that you need to top it off and you're really concerned about speed, just plug in a lightning cable and you're good to go. But I think the convenience for most people is going to offset that because they don't simply need, you know, that level of speed, or let's put it like this, they're not measuring it.
You made a good point. Inductive charging, like your Apple Watch, seems like a good place to be on your nightstand, where if somebody makes you an urgent 2 a.m. phone call, you don't have to turn on the light and pull out the plug and fumble with the phone and drop it on the floor. You just pick it up. So Right. That might be the use profile on the nightstand. And then in your office in the daytime, you know, top it off.
Right. Again, and topping it off doesn't mean finding a cable and plugging in. It means just putting the phone down and still seeing everything. We've seen a lot of cars now that are adding this. And, you know, from a car perspective, this is about as perfect as you get. You get into the car, you put your phone down, and all of a sudden your phone is now connected to all the stuff in your car that you want it to, from Bluetooth and, you know, CarPlay, etc. So this is a pretty big deal. I don't think we've seen the final implementation. And I think, you know, Apple's shown us that this is not the final implementation. And if you, you know, watch the commercials and stuff like that, and you read the fine print, it says, yeah, all this cool stuff is coming in 2018. Don't expect it today. But just the basic charging stuff that works with pretty much, you know, anything that's out there, and there's so many different devices, and the ability to put this down, you know, even as we were, you know, preparing for this conversation, I looked at my phone, saw what was going on, just plopped it down, didn't even think about it, didn't have to sit there and, you know, and fumble for a cable. Right. Yeah, does it matter, you know, in the 5, 10, 30 seconds it best that it takes me to do it? No. But again, it's another one of these little things, these details that Apple puts into all of its products that makes the difference. So as an individual feature, okay, so what? Other people have it. When you add it up to the sum of everything else that's in the 10, and by the way, this is true of the 8 series as well, it's a super convenience, and Apple is working pretty hard to make sure that other folks are getting involved in this, particularly things that are important. And to me, we're one of the most important things, this isn't a car where I don't have to sit there and fumble for a cable and pull a cable in and you know, find a place to put it in. It's just there, put my phone down and, you know, drive away with all the added features.
Wow. Guess what? We're out of time again. Well, that was
surprise.
Fast. That went fast. I have time for one more question. Do you think it was wise to overuse the side button? I think one presses Wake Up, two presses Apple Pay, and I think three presses does SOS or something. So
five presses is SOS. Again, these are new gestures, and they're things that you have to learn. But let's face it, most people don't have to figure out how to way to shut down their phone. Most people don't have to figure out a way to reset their phone. And it's not like the current devices are so intuitive in doing any of those things. People have just learned them across the board. So no, I don't think it's a particularly big issue. I guess my only question is the difference between squeezing the two buttons together to get to the emergency SOS versus, you know, being able to, you know, hit five buttons at a time. I mean, if you're in the crisis and you need to do that, I'm not sure you really particularly care about one or the other. And of course, one of the things that has always concerned me as someone that actually has had to use this feature in, you know, other devices personally is they're not particularly intuitive. So, you know, if you're lying there on the ground and someone picks up your phone, they don't necessarily know how to get 911 to you or to get your prescriptions or to call the people. But I think Apple's done about as good a job as they can. And remember, we're talking about a new set of gestures, new sets of interactions, new sets of button pushes. But to be clear, this is the future. It is unlikely we're going to see devices that go back to the rest of it. The prices will come down. This is aspirational. And frankly, I think Apple is going to sell every single one of these that they can possibly make. And you know, I'll leave this as the last part. The amazing thing to me was with the pre-orders, there were still people standing in line around the block twice in New York to buy it. And that's with, like I said, the ability to pre-order the device, which you didn't have on the first one. So clearly, there is still a lot of market enthusiasm for this particular device. There is a strong lineup of devices. And I think Apple's going to have a pretty good holiday season when it comes to selling these things.
I agree. I think you're absolutely right on all counts. Well, it was a pleasure to have you back on the show. You've been a stellar and frequent guest. Let's keep it up. And thanks for telling us about your experiences with the iPhone X.
It's been my pleasure, and hopefully we'll talk about things in the future like maybe HomePod, which we could probably do a whole other segment on just in the fact that it's been delayed.
Sure, we'll plan for that. So tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Anyhow, you can find me on Twitter at Gartenberg, or you can feel free to email me at Gartenberg@gmail.com or m@michaelgartenberg.com. And my phone number is 201-862-0443 if you just feel like calling and schmoozing.
Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It was great to have you. And folks, thanks for coming by and listening to the fantastic Michael Gartenberg. And we will see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.